Listeners of the Europeans, you are witnessing a historic world first. This is the first ever episode of this podcast recorded off the continent, or like 50% at least. On one end of the Skype call is my charming co-host, Dominic Kramer, in Amsterdam as usual. But on this end, it's Katie, usually in Paris, but today I find myself unexpectedly in South Africa. What?
Should we cancel the episode? Because I feel like it shouldn't be called the Europeans. Now you're not in Europe.
The Europeans and Africans. Things have taken a very unexpected turn this week. I'm in Johannesburg. I got a call last Wednesday saying, can you fly out tonight and help the office there for a bit? They're covering the Zimbabwe elections and it's a massive story. And you've got 15 minutes to pack a suitcase. Go! So that's where I am. It's been a really interesting experience covering it. It's the first elections after Robert Mugabe got kicked out, obviously, so it does feel quite historic. But I haven't really seen anything of Johannesburg. I've been literally sleeping here in the office and just bashing out breaking news all the time. But yeah, it's really cool to be here. And the nice thing is, it's way less hot here than it is in Europe because of the heat wave, because it's spring here in Africa. That's all I needed to do to escape the heat wave. Who knew it? Go to Africa.
It's not spring in the whole of Africa though, Katie, is it?
I don't know. I'm not very good at African weather patterns, but in this bit, it's spring and it is delightful.
I'm kind of glad you're finally working hard.
What do you mean?
After all your holidays.
That is so unnecessarily harsh, but yes, it was deserved.
And for once, I've been having a relaxing week because it's been Gay Pride in Amsterdam. It still is. In fact, it's currently Saturday when we're recording and I'm about to head off to the Canal Parade. I had this weird thing that happened the other night. People are really friendly in Amsterdam during Pride Week. I mean, they're sometimes friendly anyway. No, they're not. I'm lying. They're not friendly at all. But they are friendly this week. And I ended up speaking to this woman outside a bar very late at night after a few beers. And she was from Estonia. And like, I didn't give away at all that I have a podcast that's interested in European identity. But she literally just started spouting to me drunkenly about the various intricacies around identity for Estonians. And the fact that she feels Northern European, she feels more connected to Finland. She found it really super strange when she moved here and people referred to her as Eastern European in this kind of disparaging way as well. I just thought, like, how do I have like a face that says, come and speak to me about European identity? Or have we been doing this podcast too long?
I actually pinned a sign to your back a few months ago saying, talk to me about Europe. Have you not noticed yet?
That makes sense. Okay, stupid joke over. Let's get on with the show.
All right, let's do it. I have a little confession to make, listeners. I kind of left Dominic in the lurch this week because I've been out here in South Africa working like crazy. So he's interviewed both of our guests single-handedly. What a hero. I'm quite keen to hear what you sound like as an interviewer in my absence. Like, did you get really drunk on power and start shouting at them and ask, like, are you going to resign? And that kind of thing.
Yeah, I took the kind of Jeremy Paxman route and was really tough with them.
Oh, good.
I actually kind of enjoyed it. It was quite fun.
Oh, nice to hear you miss me.
Yeah. No, obviously come back, Katie.
Whatever.
But we have two interviews for you this week, or I have two interviews for you this week. The first one will be with Timo Lochocki, who is a lecturer on European politics at Humboldt University Berlin and Bard College Berlin, who is a specialist in populism. We thought he would be the perfect person to talk to about the rather ominous figure who's been gracing our shores these last few weeks, the Grim Reaper, Steve Bannon.
Bit much, but okay.
Well, he was represented as the Grim Reaper in Saturday Night Live, remember?
Oh, yeah. But I just wonder if you're jumping on the bandwagon of presenting Steve Bannon as this massive threat to Europe, which is he? I don't know. Maybe that will come up.
Wait until you hear my interview.
Okay,
yeah,
okay.
Katie, I ask all the right questions.
Good to hear it.
And then we will be speaking to someone who is the manager of collections at such an interesting project, Europeana. It's the European Union's cultural heritage project.
They take museum content from Europe and put it on the internet, is that it?
Yeah, and library and gallery and other academic stuff. But we were particularly interested to talk to him at the moment because he's working on a migration story project where they're collecting stories of migration from any members of the public across the continent and having various events around them and collating them into a big collection. So that is coming up later. But first, good week, bad week.
Good week, bad week.
A little bit specific, But if you are the parent of a small child and you live in Berlin, it has been a very good week for you because the city became the first in Germany, the first state in Germany, in fact, to announce that it's going to abolish fees for preschool. They're going to be saving like hundreds of euros a month each, which is great because they can spend it on other stuff that kids like. What do kids like?
Haribo.
Haribo. Oh, Paw Patrol. Do you know about Paw Patrol?
I don't know what that is, no.
It's this really cool TV program with all these dogs that are firefighters and do other public service jobs. It's really fun.
They also love Hotel Transylvania, according to the kids I was talking to yesterday.
Do they? You're so with it, with the youth. Well done. Anyway, there will be a lot of parents celebrating over this and maybe even thinking of moving to Berlin because of it. And it's good news, obviously, especially for parents who have low salaries who were really struggling with these kind of fees. But not everyone thinks it's a good idea. Some people have pointed out that there's been really chronic underinvestment in childcare in Berlin. And since it's going to cost local authorities a ton of money to provide all these services for free, the quality of care for these kids might get worse. But the government has announced that it's going to invest quite a lot of extra money. It sparked quite a lot of controversy in Germany, this announcement, because there's now parents in other parts of the country saying, wait a second, this isn't fair, because depending on which state you're in, the cost of childcare can vary really, really massively. So in some places, parents pay about 2% of their income, and in some states, it's up to 10% of their income. So there's these really massive disparities, yeah. So we're going to have to see how it turns out in Berlin. Other states are cutting their preschool fees quite a lot, but what Berlin's doing in getting rid of the fees completely is pretty radical. I should say it's not like 100% free. Parents are still going to have to pay 23 euros a month for food for the kids and 90 euros for activities, but they've got rid of the fees for the schooling itself. I mean, you're moving temporarily to Berlin. Maybe you can report back.
Yeah, maybe I can. I mean, I'm not sure I'll be hanging out with
I'll
be going to any like preschoolers much to be able to report back. But I guess some of the people I'm working with might have kids.
Have you told everyone about your move to Berlin?
No, I'm going to Berlin for September and October for a really nice opera. It's a very pan-European piece. Again, these projects seem to find me.
Well done, darling.
It's based on the French composer Debussy, fragments of him, but it's been rewritten and reworked, this piece based on Edgar Allan Poe novel by a Belgian composer called Annelies van Parijs. We've got a Swedish conductor, a French director, I think another Romanian in the cast, and it's going to be really creepy and I'm playing a scary doctor.
Great.
Typecast again.
It sounds like your perfect role, your dream role, in fact, even better than when you were a clown. It's kind of the antithesis of your last role.
Oh, it is the antithesis of the Holocaust role I just did.
That's true. But you're being creepy again, and I wonder whether they cast you in these roles deliberately because there's something about your face or your manner.
Thanks.
Anyway, who's had a bad week?
It's been a bad week for the Public Transport Organisation of Amsterdam. I realise I might be jumping the gun with this because it's probably been a really good week for them because they've just launched this north-south metro line that's been coming for like 40 years and it's been a success. But there's one detail that makes it a bad week for them and I wanted to talk about it. They had to apologise because of an uproar following the release of newly recorded announcements on the Amsterdam trams. Social media went crazy following the release because apparently the voice sounds weird. Among other insults, the voiceover man has been compared to a drunken Brit.
That's not an insult necessarily.
Exactly. And there are lots of drunken Brits who use these trams, sadly. Lots of people have been finding it very funny, although when I listened to a recording of it, it didn't sound that strange to me. And maybe this is a sign that I am not integrated into Dutch society enough yet.
Oh dear.
Yeah.
Can we play it?
Yeah, go on.
Station Lelyland. Overstappen op de lijnen 50, 62, 63 en treinverbond en trein. Vergeet u straks niet uit te checken. Please remember to check out.
He's quite stern, isn't he?
He is quite stern. And the sad thing about this story is that the voices selected for the public transport aren't voice artists or celebrities or anything. They're regular workers from within the ranks of the transport system. Hmm. So they selected 6 voices initially, about 6 months ago. And the public then voted on which of the 6 they'd like to have as the voiceover. So Walter Bonn, he won alongside his colleague Nancy Kandorp. And she does the announcements when something unusual is happening, like a delay or are a diversion because apparently, according to this article I read in Arte 5, it is scientifically proven that we accept bad news from women better than men.
Is it? That's the one advantage we have as a gender.
Yeah, apparently.
Fantastic.
Anyway, they both spent many hours in the studio over the past few months, and according to an interview with Arte 5, Walter had a tendency to sound a little bit Shakespearean, and they had to like work quite hard to knock that out of him. I imagine it's kind of come as a bit of a blow to find out that people are now laughing at his announcements.
Aww.
And it turns out that the Amsterdam Transport Authority have said that it's all their fault and that it's not the way he's saying it, but the way the tracks have been joined together, like they're slightly clipped and strange, and they are going to sort it out. Apparently they hadn't checked it through properly, and they're going to go back to the drawing board with the same recordings and make it sound more normal. So it's been a bad week for the transport organisation, but I hope it's not been such a bad week for Walter. And I wanted to send Walter our official European best wishes. And as we said earlier, we don't think it's that strange. So we'd still give it like 3 stars.
I like the idea of a Shakespearean underground announcement or tram announcement.
Yeah, they should have just rolled with it. Why did they try and knock that out of him?
You're an Amsterdam resident. Why can't they get you to do a sort of more operatic one?
Okay, let's campaign for this.
What's the name of your local stop?
Houthavens.
Oh, that's nice. They should just get you in instead. Steve Bannon. Do you remember that guy who ran a website called Breitbart and helped this guy called Donald to run a campaign a little while ago? Remember?
Katie, we're not meant to refer to them by their first name because it kind of makes them seem harmless.
What, Steve and Donald?
Yeah. I read an article about it, people saying like we shouldn't refer to these far-right populists by their first name, Boris and Donald and Steve.
Steve. I actually think it makes him sound less threatening though, which is
yeah, me too.
Maybe a good thing.
Yeah, but that's the problem. No.
Yeah, true. It's normalizing them.
Yeah.
Very sorry. Steve Bannon, Donald Trump. There you go. Bannon is kind of at a loose end at the moment after he got sacked from the White House. So he's been looking around for something to do. And there have been some quite scaremongery news reports in recent weeks about the new foundation that he wants to set up in Brussels, or has set up, in fact, called The Movement, which sounds like a cult or like a quite bad indie band. Bannon's big grand plan was apparently to unite the European far right under the Steve Bannon umbrella, which sounds wonderful. But I gather that the parties themselves, far right parties across Europe, are not exactly clamouring to get on the bandwagon. Is that right?
Yeah, that is right. Far right parties in Italy, France, Finland and Sweden, to name but a few, have all responded pretty tentatively to Bannon's overtures. But he's going to carry on trying to help them out with policy ideas, polling, strategy. He's going to try and hook them up with various Russian hackers. Kidding about that last one.
Funny joke.
But anyway, I had a really interesting chat with Timo Lahoki about Bannon and populism in Europe generally. I started by asking him why he thought the far-right parties of Europe have not all been totally open to Steve Bannon's overtures.
His prime endeavor is to try to be an important joint between European far-right movements. And this in itself is a rather complicated idea because the far-right movements in Europe, they run on a nationalist campaign, meaning their prime raison d'être is not to work together with parties from other countries. So it's very difficult to see how this mission, which was accomplished in the States, can be used for cross-fertilization in the European Union.
Some in the media this week have been saying that we shouldn't even be talking about the fact that Steve Bannon's here because it just gives him more oxygen and he's only setting up a small think tank with up to 10 full-time staff by 2019. So it's not exactly a huge empire he's building. Are we giving him too much free publicity by even discussing this?
Yes, period.
Okay, good. but if we don't talk about him, then he doesn't go away, does he?
Right, but basically what you currently speak about is exactly a part of the winning formula of the far right, be it in the States or in Europe. They thrive on a simple trick. They put something forward which is primarily meant to arise a public irritation or a public outrage. Then the media reports about it, and then they can say, well, you know, it's not as complicated as you consider it, or it's not as mean or nationalist or racist or xenophobic as it sounded at first place, and that you overreacted is another proof or evidence that you're part of the hyper-progressive liberal elite. So basically, media is doing Steve Bannon a massive favor in reporting about this with this outrage and concern to me as a researcher, it's a bit flabbergasting and mesmerizing and saddening that European media is still playing the game, even though this is the prime mechanism why the far right in Europe gained traction over the last 10 years.
Yeah, although I was quite encouraged to see that parts of the media, at least, were reporting it, saying things like Steve Bannon hasn't been welcomed with open arms in Europe. Surely reporting something like that doesn't work into his arms. It's kind of emasculating.
Right, true. But in general, there is the saying that the far right has the following advantage. There is no thing as bad publicity. Because as long as they are talked about, voters consider these issues as of prime interest. The more media space is occupied with reports about the far right cooperation or whatnot, the less media space is occupied by other issues which are really important, namely the economic situation, social affairs, and so forth.
I saw one article in the Times of London that was particularly, I felt, walking into Steve Bannon's hands. It was a comment piece where they were suggesting that he should be banned from entering any European countries. And I imagine you would definitely think that was the wrong tack.
Just totally ridiculous. Again, this helps the far right because they can then play on this. We are the victims of being ostracized by, again, the progressive elites, which apparently would even damage or change the liberal civil rights just to keep someone like me with an open mind out of the country. No, these people should just be treated like normal citizens from the United States, not more and not less.
Do you have any examples within Europe where you think there's a country or a political party that's responding well?
I'm afraid not in the last 10, 20 years.
Oh dear.
Because there is this public overreaction. But what we've seen is that in the 90s, in Sweden and Germany, you had far-right movements also being on the rise. So you had the party called New Democracy in Sweden, and the Republikaner, the Republicans in Germany. And the established parties at one point, and the media as well, stopped reacting to them. They just didn't pick up whatever they uttered. And this was a massive blow to both parties because they were deprived of the media attention they needed in order to make sure that voters kept their ideas in mind. So if you want to have a look at what works, quote unquote, against the far right, studying a bit of party history in Sweden and Germany is a worthwhile undertaking.
Are there any countries in Europe that are bucking the trend and haven't seen much of a rise in the far right?
Yes. Basically, it's Portugal, Spain and Ireland. And to some extent, it's also Greece. And there is a pretty simple reason for this, because these countries are hit the hardest by European austerity measures. And this sounds counterfactual or paradoxical at first.
Yeah, it does.
But actually, far-right parties, they need benign economic conditions. They need a good economic setup. Why? Because then, when the economy is doing rather fine, voters have enough time to worry about other issues. And this is also the time when the two big parties tend not to argue about too many things because the economic outlook is fine, so there seems to be no reasons to argue about things. These factors both lead to voters believing, aha, the economy is doing fine, so maybe we should talk about migration. And the two big parties have the same opinion on economic matters, so maybe they are a bunch of corrupt elites. In other countries where the economic situation is very severe, there is very, very little space for migration topics. And if established parties argue fiercely about economics, they can hardly be accused of being similar and being part of the same corrupt elite.
So that's really interesting. I've never heard it expressed in this way. I have one final question about Steve Bannon. I was wondering if you think he actually has anything to offer the far right here. I mean, obviously the American political system is completely different. And I mean, some would argue that he wasn't even that helpful to Donald Trump, particularly towards the end or once he was in the White House.
What Steve Bannon is currently bringing to Europe are two things. For one, he brings a thought through, quote unquote, far right agenda and 10 media savvy professionals. But both we already have in Europe nearly times 20. The far right in Europe is a very established actor. They have professional structures, and they also have a thought-through far-right narrative. It's very difficult to imagine that these huge parties with millions of state funding in France or in Germany or the Netherlands, that they need someone or they need an operation which is worth, I don't know, a few million euros. No, it's hardly imaginable that Steve Bannon leaves a massive imprint on the European party scene.
if we follow Tima's advice, we probably should never talk about Steve Bannon ever again. And we should probably not even talk about any like controversies that the far-right populists do or say ever again.
But we really like Tima. We want to get him back on the show. What do we do about that?
Yeah. We're in a bind.
Timo is on Twitter. You can follow him at @TLochocki. That's TLochocki. And we will add a link in our show notes.
I'm now going to get on the line to Adrian Murphy, who is the collections manager of Europeana. It's a really cool project. And it's one of those things that I just think it's amazing that it's actually happening.
I do think it's a really cool idea to like put all of this museum stuff on the internet. Partly for people who can't get there. Maybe they don't live in a big city or they're like not physically mobile. It's cool.
If you're still not quite clear what we're talking about, Adrian does a much better job than we do at describing what it exactly is.
We list the collections of museums, galleries, libraries and archives around Europe. We currently have around 58 million items listed on there, and they're from around 3,500 different institutions around Europe. On Europeana, we have a vast array of types of cultural heritage, whether artworks or photography. There's documents, archival documents, letters, postcards that people sent in the past, music, sound, film, even some 3D scans of objects. This is our 10-year anniversary. And this year, our campaign that we're focusing on is about migration to, from, and within Europe.
How does something like this like come to fruition? It sounds like such a lovely idea, but how are the right people persuaded within the EU? Whose idea was this?
I think it stemmed initially from the EU themselves. And I think initially there were a number of national libraries in European countries. And they decided to bring the library collections together initially. And then it grew from there with a very large amount of passion and energy and enthusiasm, a large network of professionals in museums and galleries, libraries and archives, as well as the sort of technologists who made all this happen.
What are your statistics as to like who is actually using this? Have you been surprised at the kind of people that are interested in it?
We know that it's used in the main by researchers, educators, people who want to be able to use artworks and so on for creative reasons, for inspiration, and even people who just want to enjoy it. So on top of the listings and the sort of database site of 58 million, we have online exhibitions, blogs, galleries, so people can enjoy just by reading and seeing what's available.
And have you been welcomed by most museums and galleries that you've approached, or are some people resistant to having things digitized and put online?
I think there's over the last 10 years, there's a very big debate in the museum, gallery, library, archive sector about digitization, and some are skeptical, some are a little nervous of doing that, but those who have taken that journey and started that kind of transformation have really seen the benefits of doing so. I think a lot of museums and galleries and libraries and so on have a lot of pressure in terms of resources, so they don't necessarily see digitization as the number one thing to do. But those who have done it really, really see the benefit of it and really see how it is working towards their goals about improving access to their collections, engaging new audiences with them, and becoming part of the international collaborations.
And at the moment, you're working on a migration story project, which is slightly different to your normal collection, I believe. Could you tell us a bit about what you're doing?
So the migration campaign that we're working on this year actually is inspired by a campaign that we've been running for the last 5 years. In that project, we invited people to share their stories of the First World War, which we digitized. We found that was a very rewarding campaign, very engaging and very participatory. 2018 is the European Year of Cultural Heritage, the theme of which is about where the past meets the future. So we thought that we would apply the model of the First World War project to migration and invite people to share their stories of migration to, from, and within Europe. We think that's a really nice way to connect people with their cultural heritage and to show that the geographical movement of people has made culture richer in Europe. They're recorded on our website, and they're available for people to browse and explore.
And if people want to submit things, can they do that online, or do they have to go to one of the special events?
We have a lot of events around Europe this year, but yes, people can also submit online. The address is migration.europeana.eu/share.
Well, I think it's a really nice project, and I might even share some stuff, because I also think it's quite a nice way of having to go back and think about my family's history of migration and speak to the older members of my family about it. So you talked about these events that have been happening across the continent, and there are a few more coming up. I was wondering what people could expect if they came to these events.
Well, when people come to the events, they usually bring an object with them, which sort of symbolizes the story or is an element of their story. And they are interviewed, they share their own story. Then we take temporarily the object and digitize that. We take photographs of it or scan it. At some of the events, there are also exhibitions or maybe some talks for people to enjoy while they're waiting for their object to be digitized. We had an event in Utrecht here in the Netherlands, which was at the Instituto Cervantes. And that was a really vibrant event. A lot of people from the Spanish-speaking community came along to that. And you could really see that this was a sort of a very big community event for them. They were very proud to share the stories that they had about life in the Netherlands. And each event is a little different in a way, but the central part of it is about sharing a story and having an object digitized.
Well, I think it sounds like a really beautiful project, and I'm sorry I've missed the ones in the Netherlands already, but you do have a few coming up quite soon, don't you? Is there one in Dublin just in the next few weeks?
Yeah, our next event is in Dublin. It's on the 18th and 19th of August. It's at a museum called EPIC, the Irish Emigration Museum. We then have events after that in September in Zagreb, in October in Pisa, Belgrade, Luxembourg, in November in Riga, in Limerick in Ireland, and in Athens. So it's a really pan-European project, a really nice way for people to connect with their cultural heritage.
It's one of those weeks where maybe we don't even need a happy ending, because I feel quite uplifted by Adrian's wonderful project.
Just abolish happy ending. Let's start a new thing called like grim ending or something.
Yeah, maybe we should like flip between the two. Anyway, I do have a happy ending, and Katie, you're going to wish you'd never said we should scrap this segment, because it's another happy ending from your hometown. It's the second one from your hometown, and I think therefore your hometown of Southend is now the town with the most happy endings.
Wait a second, last time you said my hometown was Colchester, which was flagrantly wrong. It is near, but not my hometown. I'm taking it this is actually about my hometown, Southend-on-Sea.
This is actually about Southend-on-Sea, yeah. Do you remember what the last one was?
Was it about a goat and a cow that were friends or something? No, chickens and a
dog. You need to concentrate more. It was a dog who adopted orphan ducklings at Mount Fitchett Castle. Anyway,
animals, shmanimals.
This story is slightly less cute and slightly more urine soaked. This is the story of a modern day hero. Let's call him Thomas Watson, because that's his name. Thomas Watson claims that he averted a very near disaster on Southend Pier. But before I go any further, paint a picture of Southend Pier for those listeners who've never been, including me.
Southend Pier is the longest pleasure pier in the world. It's something I'm very proud of. You can actually see it, I think, from Google Maps. If you go on Southend-on-Sea and zoom out, you can see it. It's really very impressive. It's a pier that was built, maybe 150 years ago. That's probably wrong. To serve tourists coming when my hometown was a sort of a prized seaside resort for Londoners coming down to take in the seaside air, and all the boats would dock there. And these days, what is on it? There's a train that can take you out all the way, because it's quite long. It's more than a mile long.
Yeah, it's like a few kilometres, I think.
It's pretty long. And there are some slot machines, and you can buy donuts. It's a wonderful place.
Sounds great. Well, so Southenders would be very sad if anything happened to the pier, as it did in 2005 when it was pretty devastated by a horrible fire. Mm. But back to present day and to Thomas Watson. He was walking along the pier at closing time when it was completely deserted, and he saw some flames through the floorboards from the dry wood below. Fortunately, he is a quick thinker and he had a full bladder, so he, quote, felt confident and he got down on his knees so that he could be more precise. He peed on the fire despite the wind. He was accurate because he was kneeling down and the fire went out. So according to the wonderful British tabloid, ironic, The Sun, the council have thanked him for his quick thinking tinkling.
Well done, Thomas.
Yeah, he's a real hero.
About 15 people sent this story to me as soon as it happened and I am delighted by it. Is it real? I do not know. I hope so, though.
The council did thank him, but then they also insisted that the Piers sprinkler system would have sorted it out. After the fire in 2005, they've got really good sprinklers. But happy ending either way, and it's nice to talk about Southend again. Once more.
It's nice to talk about peeing so much as well. Why do we always end up talking about piss on this show?
Oh, yes. Sorry. This is the second episode in a row that I've brought up a peeing story. I'm sorry. I promise it's the last.
Piss and populism are two main themes.
Well, that's a good title for this episode.
Thank you very much for joining us in yet another episode of The Europeans. That makes it sound like I'm tired of doing it. I'm not. I had fun this week.
It's only our second this season.
I also had a lot of fun because you did most of the work.
That's true.
You should do the interviews every week. It's been great.
So thank you to me for doing most of the work this week. And thank you to Katie for doing all the editing as usual.
And thank you to our guests.
Oh yeah, them too.
Them too. Timo Lochocki and Adrian Murphy. And as usual, our one-man jingle factory, Jim Barn.
We will be back next week as usual. I will be in Deal, I think.
Where's that?
On the Kent coast.
Ooh.
In fact, this is really fun. I'm going to a wedding in Sandwich and I'm staying in Deal. Sandwich Deal.
Sandwich Deal, like a meal deal.
Yeah.
It's not really that good a pun, is it?
Oh.
I'll be back in Paris, I think. I hope, depending on how things go here. So we'll be back to Europe as usual. If you miss us in the meantime, you can join us on the internet. We are on Twitter at EuropeansPod and Instagram at EuropeansPodcast. Do send me your pictures of your favourite corners of Europe and ugliest corners, whatever. We just want to see where you are.
Have a great week. Auf Wiedersehen.
Ta-ra.